Welcome, everyone. We're going to get started.
I'm Tara Roberts, and I'm Vice President of Products and User Experience for Oracle Adaptive Intelligence. And I'm thrilled to be here to support the advancements of women leaders from across the state and beyond. Oracle is the world's largest business software company, but like the presenters speaking today, it all started with an idea. Since launching the first commercial relational database in 1977, Oracle has been committed to innovation and customer success. We're proud to be a partner of Texas Conference for Women. Thank you for participating in this breakout session, Innovation Quotient, Making Your Mighty Idea a Reality. We have a fantastic hour in store for you today. I am excited to introduce Natalie Molina Nino, who is a serial entrepreneur with passion and focus on businesses that deliver economic benefits to women. Ms. Molina Nino is the CEO and the founder of Breva Investments and the co-founder of Entrepreneurs at Athena at Columbia University. She is a true thought leader and an author of Leapfrog, a must-read book for women entrepreneurs. Please put your hands together and welcome Ms. Natalie Molina Nino. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Tara. Oracle was a former client of mine, so we have more history than I think I realized walking in. It's amazing to be here, and it's amazing to be here, especially after a really historic week. But I wanted to get a sense before we introduce our brilliant panelists and give you a sense of who's in the room. I wanted to get a sense of who's on this side of the room. And so if it's okay with you, because we're talking about innovation, we're talking about taking your big idea and making it real, it's really useful for us to know what perspective you're coming from. Are you an entrepreneur? Are you an intrapreneur within a corporation? So maybe by show of hands, how many people in the room are entrepreneurs? And you can be both, but so feel free to raise your hand twice. So entrepreneur, great. You've made the leap. What about an intrapreneur within a corporation? Great. And then what about people who are thinking of being an entrepreneur, thinking of making that leap on the precipice? All right, some of you have multiple businesses, I can tell. and then what about just people who, whatever context you're in, you identify as an innovator, as somebody who is building, making things? Yeah, that's great. Beautiful. We're in, and that includes people who are retired. That includes people who haven't made the leap yet, but maybe will or have. So as Tara kindly said, I'm Natalie Molina Nino. I am the founder and the CEO of Breva Investments. We do invest in companies that can prove to us that they're making an economic benefit to as many women as possible. That's the deal. And then I am an author, newly minted author, as is one of my panelists. Both of us will be signing books later today. In fact, immediately after, I believe. And really, the reason for the book, just rather than giving you an overview of what the book is, I'll tell you why. And the story that probably tells it best is that when I was 7 or 8 years old, my grandmother, who came to the United States as a grandmother, so later in her life, P.S., how many of you know that there's actuarial data that proves unequivocally that women over the age of 50 are twice as likely to be successful as entrepreneurs?
Wow, I didn't know.
Anyone? Yeah, I'm so glad. I love dropping that stat. If Silicon Valley made decisions based on real data, then it would be crawling with nothing but women over the age of 50. But as we know, they don't make decisions based on data. So when I was 6 or 7, my grandmother, who had managed to move to the United States, and she was determined to bring all 5 of her kids from our home country of Ecuador to the United States, and over the course of 20 years, on the salary of and on the wages of a seamstress, she worked in the sweatshops of Los Angeles, always had a side hustle, made wedding dresses and quinceañera dresses on the weekends and in the evenings. She was a master seamstress. And so when I was 7 or 8 one day, I used to stay up late with her and watch her sew. And I remember I asked her if she would teach me to sew. It seems natural. I would sketch things, she would make them. She was a creator, she made beautiful things. I wanted to learn how to do the same. And for the first and last time in my entire life, my grandmother lost it. She turned off the machine, she shifted her whole body over to me, and she had a look on her face like I have never seen and again, never again saw. She was livid. And what came out of her mouth was something I didn't quite understand until later in life, which was, no, I will not teach you to sew, because you will never work with your hands. Mm. And I disagree with my grandmother. Working with your hands is honorable work. But I now understand what she meant, right? She meant, it's your job to take this family further than I've taken it. It's your job to work as smart as I did hard. It's your job to leapfrog us into that next level. And that was really the motivation for me to write this book. I feel like we get lots and lots of crappy advice. Advice that tells us we have to raise friends and family rounds, advice that tells us that you can't have a side hustle, that in order to be taken seriously, you gotta go all in and go move into, you know, some accelerator in Silicon Valley and live in a frat house for 3 months, that you have to give up large chunks of your company to somebody who looks like those venture capitalists at Shark Tank. All of this advice that we get every single day, when the reality is most Americans don't have $5,000 in their bank account. Who are these friends and family we're meant to be raising money from? And there are many, many different ways to be innovators, not just to be entrepreneurs on your own, but to be entrepreneurs within large corporations. And so that is really the crux of the book, but it is also the crux of how this panel was created. And so I want to move on and to give you a sense of who we have here, and then also to give them an opportunity to tell you a little bit more about themselves. I will say this, we're both going to be signing books later on, right after this. Proceeds of Leapfrog go to an organization called Vote Run Lead. And for those of you that are not familiar with it, Vote Run Lead is a bipartisan organization that has put more women into elected office than any other organization in this country. It was previously within an organization called the White House Project. And especially more women of color into elected office. They are behind training people like Stacey Abrams in Georgia or Ilhan Omar in Wisconsin. They are an amazing organization, and that's where proceeds go. But if we talk about who's in the room, I love that we had almost what looked like equal parts entrepreneurs and entrepreneurs. Because what we have up here is a representation of all three. An investor, in my case, former, I would say, entrepreneurial junkie. And then we have two entrepreneurs that are in the thick of it right now. And then we have an entrepreneur whose title actually includes the word innovation. So, like, a true innovator in every way. And so I want to talk about our three panelists, Amy Porter, Jessica, and Jessica, please make sure that I don't mispronounce your name.
Honegger,
and Leah Sims. I'm gonna take a quick stab, but because I will not be able to do them justice, I will ask them to also tell you a little bit more about themselves. But Amy is the founder and CEO of Affinipay. Which is one of Inc. Magazine's fastest growing companies, and it's been on that list since 2012. She's also EY Entrepreneur of the Year in 2017. And Jessica is the author of Imperfect Courage, Live a Life of Purpose by Leaving Comfort and Going Scared. She's also a masochist like me. She is both an entrepreneur and an author. And she's the CEO of Noonday Collection, which also is on the Inc. fastest growing company list and is also EY Entrepreneur of the Year in 2017. And then Leah, I know, this bump, whatever. No big deal, right? Just a couple slackers. Leah Sims is Assistant Vice President in Enterprise and Innovation at USAA, and she leads member and employee innovation programs since 2006, and she's going to talk to us about how we innovate and grow and create things and manifest brilliant ideas within a large corporation, which, for those of you that are entrepreneurs, still really useful information to know, because guess who your clients are going to be? People like Leah, right? And so you all have different needs. And I would argue that you might think that your experience is radically different, whether you're within or without an organization, but we're going to do our best, given who we have here on stage, to try to represent all of your needs and concerns to the extent possible. And then we're going to make sure that we stop at 15 minutes to give you plenty of time to ask us questions. We're going to have you walk up to the mics so that you can come up and ask all of the things that we didn't cover during the rest of the session. So do me a favor. What I want to be able to make sure that everybody walks away from here with is a sense of how they make their big idea a reality. That's the goal. And I also want to say that because women are already entrepreneurial, right? Women are starting more companies than men in the United States. A lot of people know that. But what a lot of people don't know is that 8 out of every 10 of those businesses are started by a woman of color. So women, especially women of color, we're already entrepreneurial. So I don't think that we need to give advice on how to take the risks, how to be entrepreneurial. I feel like we've already got that. All of you, you've got that. But what we need to do is give tools, I think, to be able to then take those ideas and make them real. And so I guess the first things first, tell us a little bit more about you, what I didn't cover, because I was brief. But because my research tells me that really half the battle is identifying as an innovator, identifying as somebody that can create and manifest things. I would love to know, apart from who you are, what led you to identify yourself as somebody who could create and innovate and manifest an idea and make it real? Do you want to start?
Okay, so I will start with a really random fact that I've never started before, but you just made me want to start with it. I have three children, one of whom we adopted from Rwanda, my littlest one. And my middle child, I gave birth to him at home, and he was almost 11 pounds. So I'm like a known heroine throughout Austin, actually. But the reason I share that with you is because the reason I wanted to do a home birth is because my company, we work with vulnerable women all around the world. We've been able to create jobs for 4,500 artisans, primarily many of whom are women, and work in some of the most vulnerable areas. And I wanted to stand in solidarity with them. But I knew that if I was at the hospital and I was in pain, I was gonna say, get me that epidural. So I cornered myself and said, well, at home, an epidural's not an option. And that is what I want to encourage you today as you think about your idea. How can you corner yourself so that you're stopping the Googling at night, you're stopping chatting with your friend, trying to get permission, and you just do the thing? And that really is what the story of Noonday is. Noonday Collection didn't start as an idea, it actually started as a need. We were raising money to bring our son home from Rwanda because our previous business had died on the vine. We'd been flipping houses. At one point, we owned about 5 houses, no interest loans. This is during the crazy era of the housing market bubble. And when that popped, we were soon living off of our credit cards. But we knew that we wanted to grow our family through adoption. We were halfway through the process, and we weren't going to let a financial obstacle get in our way. And I had some friends living in Uganda who were trying to create entrepreneurial opportunities for Ugandans. And one of those businesses was an artisan business. They heard about our financial need, and they said, Jessica, why don't you just sell this stuff and see if it could work? I had originally blown them off, but then when I was cornered by courage, I said yes. And I went, dusted up all the goods, invited women into my home. That was another point of being cornered, because suddenly I'm like, oh my gosh, everyone's about to come into my home, see how desperate we are, because I'm selling like grandma's dishes. Everyone's gonna see the size of my jeans, because I'm selling my clothes too. But I was cornered. I'd already made the invite. I'd already had women that were about to show up, and they came. And that was my first conversation with the marketplace. I realized that women wanted to use their purchasing power for good. They wanted to rally around our adoption, and they wanted to physically gather. Women, we are so powerful. Isn't today has been so powerful? Because we're physically, we're off of our phones, we're in real life, and there's so much power in that. And so after that night is when the idea came. What if this could be not just a fundraiser, but a business? What if other women would open their homes too? And other women did open their homes. And 8 years later, we now have 60 employees in our Austin office. And that original Ugandan couple that I sold their products that night now have 100 full-time employees in Uganda. And we now have a social network of entrepreneurs around the country called Noonday Collection Ambassadors. And these are the women, the entrepreneurs that are creating a marketplace for businesses like Jolly and Daniel in Uganda, and now the 30 other businesses that we partner with. So again, I say, corner yourself with courage and go, which is also the message of my book.
Oh, I love it. Yes.
Awesome. I just got mic drop. You're done. Yeah, that's awesome. I'm all about the epidural. So. I just got
two very different entrepreneurial styles.
Yes.
Yeah. I guess to answer your question, you know, what, how did I start or what started the company? And it's funny, I actually feel empowered just from our luncheon speaker with Reese saying that ambition is not a bad word. I'm ambitious, I'm competitive, and I'm proud of that. But But I like the way she described ambition. The real reason I started my company, I was a single mom. I literally was trying to pay the bills. And so that was the way to do it for me, was to start a business, which sounds crazy. But instead of trading hours for dollars, and really to create something that I could support my family. So my ambition was in supporting my children and supporting my family, being a role model for them. This was 14 years ago as a single mom. And I kind of did a lot of things. I didn't know what I was going to do. And so I was probably sitting in the chair you guys are in right now, just trying to figure it out. I took the LSAT. I was going to go to law school. I got my insurance license. I was really just kind of all over the board. I was smart. I was ambitious. I just didn't know what my thing was. But my background and my history had been in financial payments, had been in payment processing, merchant accounts. Then this thing called the internet happened, which created all these opportunities. And for me, I was able to find a niche and find a void in that industry. And I think we're going to talk more about that later. But I just got super focused on that, hyper-focused in kind of a crazy way to fill that need and solve that problem. And I don't know if you want to go into it now, but that's all I've kind of lived and thought about it day and night for the last 13 years, and that's kind of all I've done in it. I think it takes that kind of hyper focus to cut out the noise, and I tell my team and I tell my staff this all the time, and I, it sounds crazy, but I always say, "She who chased two rabbit catches none." And so part of for me was learning what we weren't going to do and what we're not going to be. We do financial payments for professionals, so we have a payment technology, but we build apps on that for professionals. For example, we have an app called LawPay that's, think of PayPal for lawyers. And so we grew that just literally one law firm at a time using our platform to get paid. And now we have almost 40,000 law firms across the country. One in four law firms, use our technology to get paid. And that's all we do. So we don't work with restaurants. We don't work with dry cleaners. Everybody else can have that. And this is this one thing we do. And when I started this concept, even lawyers would tell me, "Oh, that's just unprofessional. Law firms won't take credit cards." Okay. Oh, I'm not. Our firm won't take credit cards. That just, that's not becoming of our law firm or this white shoe law firm. We would never do that. We don't want to put our clients in debt. They really just didn't kind of get the concept. I would go to the big banks, and they would say, "We've analyzed that market. That's just not interesting to us. There's not enough volume in that market. There's not as many clicks in that market." So they didn't see the value of payments for professional services. And it was super niche and super small, but nobody was solving that need and filling that gap. And I kind of zeroed in on it and just started doing it one day at a time. And it's literally all I've done. I also say, I tell a lot of people, act as if. I literally went and got business cards made. Fake it till you make it. Got a phone number, and I would play silly secretary, and like, "Yes, Amy's here. One moment." Got it. And just literally, I pretended to be in business until I actually was.
Yeah.
But.
And now you have how many team members?
We've got 130 here in Austin, and we're one of the fastest growing financial technology companies in the country, which is fun.
That's awesome.
So I'll answer that in kind of two ways. I'll tell you a little bit about myself and then the role from an innovation perspective at USAA that I'm able to lead. But me, myself, always in the tech field. Early career, very junior, told what to do all the time, kind of struggled through that. I will tell you, when I had my third child, I made a big decision to stay at home. So it was, that negotiation with your husband, can I stay home? How long can I do it? Can we financially work this out? That's probably when I just realized we can do anything. I can do anything I want to do. I stayed home with my kids and then decided, you know what? This isn't working out for me. I need to go back to work. That's when I started to work at USAA and found ways to get things done that seemed impossible. From a finance perspective, secured a position on the project that implemented deposit at mobile. So, people are never going to take a picture of a check and deposit it. Well, that's the only way people want to do it if they get a check right now. was able to be on a project that brought financial planning down to the masses so that it's no longer a barrier of having to have so much money before you get true financial planning. Being able to do those types of things within a corporate environment is difficult. And so that brings me to my most recent role. And it's really interesting because going through that, it's almost like it was a lesson in, okay, now your job is to seek others who have great ideas to solve problems. And how do you help them do those things? Because they have a day job and we need to find them and they still need to do what they need to do, but we may need to take those individuals offline to make those innovation ideas reality. How do we scale that across a corporation? And not all companies have it, but we're lucky at USA that we do. Mm-hmm. I think no matter the size of the company, as I've talked to people around the industry, any business owner is looking for a good idea for their employee. Mm-hmm. Any business owner would take it. As long as it aligns with the strategy and what and fixes a problem that the company has, I guarantee you, if you work in a small business or a gigantic business, the leaders at your company want a good idea to help the company move forward. It isn't always in a traditional fashion. It may not be necessarily your function, but leaders in those companies definitely want their employees to engage because it helps the broader vision. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I'm going to go with you first, actually, on that. And just to build on that, I've in my startups, in my companies, my clients were all corporations. So Microsoft in my last company was my biggest corporation, but even most recently, right, with the book Leapfrog, there's a higher bar, it feels like, for data, for modeling. If I had had my druthers, I would have called Leapfrog the book Shortcuts. Mm-hmm. But it turns out Random House tested the name, the word Shortcuts, mm-hmm. and it tested poorly. Any guesses? The reason Shortcuts tested poorly is because it turns out we women, and especially women of color, we hear Shortcuts and we think cheating. Which, you know, the World Economic Forum says that it's going to take 170 years at the pace that we're at to get to gender parity. So if any of y'all have an idea of how we shrink 170 years without taking shortcuts, talk to me afterwards. Like, we're going to have to take shortcuts. But and this is a huge corporation. They know their numbers. They know their data. And I just think that, you know, to do what you do, it takes some skill and it takes some, you know, it's more than an art, it's a science, it takes experience. And so I would love for you to share with us some tactics, like specific things that the audience can walk away with that you can do, whether you're within a corporation or even working, like in my case, in partnership with one, to take these innovative ideas and make them real.
Sure. First thing, just whatever company, small or large it is, if you know what the company is chasing and your idea aligns to that, you will have some sort of success. It may just be reaching out to an executive that you know or do not know, or leader, and share the idea with them. I will tell you too, 99% of the time, your idea, the first time you state it, will never be the same the second time you state it, especially in a corporation. Because as you talk to individuals, your story gets better. People will challenge you, which is a double-edged sword, and we can go into that later, but it's a double-edged sword because they challenge you, and sometimes that can be perceived as, oh, I got shut down. Maybe some people use the wrong words, but you individually should take that as, okay, what's my 2.0? What's my 3.0? What do I change from there? So if it's aligned, you're gonna get on the phone or in somebody's office for sure. I think the other thing too is being relentless without being annoying, and that's really hard to do because there's another person that you annoy in that. But it is believing in your idea. That means have your elevator pitch. But if somebody scratches the surface and your elevator pitch got you to one step, you better be ready with at least a little bit of information and be honest about the information that you're still working out. So having those conversations with people that you may not talk to every day is really important. So sponsorship, and it's not mentorship, but it's kind of sponsorship of your idea in different pockets of the organization. Doing your due diligence of bumping it up against if you have a design group or an accounting group, how does your idea work from their perspective? Just a quick chat over coffee or lunch can give you so much information to make your idea better.
Thank you. Jessica, you're next.
Okay.
I want to know, so one of the things that I talk about and I loved in reading about you, I sort of wish I had access to you before I finished the book, because I talk about the idea that VC is a white-collar drug. Mm. And it's not something that is even appropriate for most of us. Mm. I say in the book that, look, unless you are so passionate about your business and your idea that you want to see it out in the world, no matter what, even if it means that you could get fired from your own company, don't take VC. But if you're that passionate about your idea, and people are, if mm-hmm. I've cured breast cancer, I guarantee you, I don't care who takes it to market, just take it to market, right? Mm-hmm. But that's not right for most people. Mm. And when I see your story, and when I see story, there's a story in the book about a woman named Nina Vaca. For those of you that don't know her, she's definitely a Texas story. In her case, out of Dallas, she's the fastest growing woman-owned company in America. Mm-hmm. It's hitting $1 billion this year in revenue. And it is a company that grew without a penny of venture capital. Mm. So for people that say that that is the only way, right. I always respond with Nina Vaca. And now I can respond with your story too, because you did it as well. You went from, I was reading, from your guest bathroom to a $20 million business with 60 staff and also no VC. And you started... Again, sort of counterintuitive, you mm-hmm. started because you were broke.
Right.
And like, you know, people would say, like, who says I'm broke, let me start a business? But actually a lot of us do, and you did.
Yeah.
So I guess for you, what I would love to know is how do you manifest mm-hmm. with negative resources
in
your case, right? And how do you take that and build something from nothing? And then again, if we could do as tactical as possible.
Right. I'm glad I didn't know too much about VC funding. I knew the term angel investor, and I literally thought it was an angel. I thought it was someone that just decided, I'm going to give you some money, and you never paid them back. I guess that doesn't really exist in the world. I actually, I gathered up some gold jewelry that was heirloom jewelry from my grandma and my mom, and I went and shopped it at different pawn shops around Austin to fund our first website. And I think it really does go back to, no one's going to believe in your dream for you. You have got to believe 100,000%. You've got to take quitting off the table. You have got to absolutely believe that this is it, and that it's going to work, and that no one's doubt is going to cause you to step back, and that you're willing. I mean, at one point, I was, you know, I would ask whoever would open their home for me, I'll drive, you know, I'm going to sell you these things. And by the way, I don't have enough money for a hotel room, but can I sleep on your couch? So I was sleeping in strangers' homes, guys. But my why,
pre-Airbnb.
Pre-Airbnb.
You were actually just ahead of the game.
True. I was bad. That would have been an innovative idea. But literally, I think at first, my why was definitely, we've got to get enough money to bring Jack home. But very quickly, Jolly and Daniel are over in Uganda, and they're saying, oh, guess what? We've just hired these people. Let me tell you about Bukenya. He grew up in an orphanage, and this is the first dignified job that he's ever had where he's actually getting paid. And then she'd email me again a couple weeks later. Let me tell you about Latifa, who we just... And suddenly, when my future became linked with other people, there was no backing out.
Yeah.
And so that's why I say very quickly, you've got to somehow corner yourself. And I think one way to corner yourself is by linking yourself with someone else's success. And when you link yourself, it is very hard because you're not just quitting on yourself, you're quitting on all of these other people as well. So, you know, for me, we have a mission-based business, but I think, you know, most of us do now, right? We want to do business with meaning. We want to create meaning out of our work. And so you've got to find that meaning and that value that you're creating, and it's got to connect to your life mission, your purpose, your values, and then know when you become unstoppable when you're able to connect all of those things and integrate them into your business idea.
I have so many more questions, but Amy, like Jessica, I really wish that I had known you and been able to squeeze you into my book, because similar, you also, you know, like the majority of US entrepreneurs, you did it without VC, you did it without that Shark Tank experience. And I guess what I would love to know in your case is, you know, between the big idea and that sense of, you know, there's a hole in the market and I have to fill it, I want to know, what are the specific sort of examples of those milestones that you hit? And I'm sure, as Leah was saying, right, the idea evolved. And also just advice, what would you give people as a takeaway in terms of how to take that initial seed of an idea and almost shepherd it through to it being the sort of thing that can turn into one of the fastest growing companies in the country?
Yep. You know, I would be completely lying if I said I knew where I was going to end up and I had it all figured out. Completely not the case. And frankly, ignorance was bliss a little bit. I didn't understand VC funding. I didn't know that world at all. I don't come from a PE background or a VC background. But for me, what I did know, and I think you hit on it, was finding alignment. And so when I started the company, I really did it, and I'll give you an example, or really how I started the company was through partnerships. And I became very good at forming alliances and partnerships. So when Affinipay was started as a company, really started it with two key partnerships. One was I partnered with a back-end payment processor that would give me complete cost on my processing because I didn't have my own technology yet, so I had that technology partner. And then I also partnered with an association management company that needed payments. And so I supplied and I filled a void that they needed in their company. They actually tried to hire me to do that, and I was like, I'm not really the work for you kind of gal, but I'll partner with you on this, and I'll do this piece of the puzzle for you, and I'll find a solution with another partner. So even though I didn't take funding, it was almost like I had funding, but it was in a way that I knew how to manage. What's that?
In the form of a paying client.
In the form of clients, exactly. Yeah. And so all of a sudden, I was getting basically commission to sell processing to one of my partners through another partner, and not to get into too much detail on that, but creating relationships and creating partnerships that were good partnerships, and I kind of always take the approach that I'm willing to sit on either side of the table, and I think that is something I feel very passionate about. In other words, I'm not trying to get over on the person across from the table and walk out of the meeting going, yeah, I really got them. Those never end up being good partnerships. Those never end up being good relationships. It's okay to have that give and take, and I think as women and as females, we're very good at that. That's our secret weapon. That's our power, right? Is we can create situations where everybody wins, and those are the best partnerships. And these partnerships that I started still continue to this day, and they're really kind of the foundation of how the company grew. So when you find those opportunities, look for partnerships. Look for places where you might be able to get resources just because you're aligned with what they're trying to do too. And that doesn't necessarily cost money, but you're able to get resources. And so I had someone bringing in technology, I had someone bringing in a client base, and then for lack of anything else, I was bringing in sweat equity, experience, knowledge, the ability to just show up every day and stick with it. I'm pretty stubborn like that.
Mm. So stubbornness.
Yes, it is what it is. And throw that up there. That's not a bad word. You can be stubborn, you can be ambitious, you can be competitive. Those are good things.
No, I think impatience is another one that gets a bad rap.
Yeah, absolutely.
Think it's time to get really impatient.
Specifically in my industry, it's financial technology. People want these quick wins. They want everybody loves this whole concept of the unicorn, and they want it to happen overnight. And I think women, we have patience. We are willing to outwait anybody out there trying to compete against us, and that takes and things don't happen overnight. So I think stay with it, stay patient. It comes.
Well, and as what? How many year running? One of the fastest growing companies in the U.S. It's definitely. It does result in fast growth ultimately.
It does because then you get momentum. You figure out your market. You learn. We adapt. We're not too stubborn to change and take advantage of opportunities. And when you look for those gaps, those are really opportunities, and they're pretty powerful.
Mm-hmm. Leah, I have a hack in my book that is called Use Your Woman Card. and I say that because I think we encounter roadblocks, whether you're in a startup environment or in a corporate environment. And I say Use Your Woman Card because I think about ways that companies like yours, like Nina Vaca's, the example that I mentioned before, have grown. And a lot of them have done it in partnership with corporations, inextricably connected because of their supplier diversity programs, right? And so that's an example of something where I think you know, being a woman, especially being a woman within an affinity group. For those of you that are not familiar with this resource, there's an amazing book by a colleague of mine named Self Made. At becomingselfmade.com, for example, she's got a whole section on her website where she talks about all the programs that exist with free money, grants, potentially low interest loans, all sorts of things for women, for women who are veterans, for women with disabilities, for women who are Muslim, like all these different affinity groups. So I think that there's something to be said about using these advantages that are available to us, whether they be in private sector, public sector. But I guess my question for you is, do you, and in your experience, has it been an advantage, or have some of the obstacles that you've faced been uniquely female-oriented obstacles?
I will tell you personally, they've probably been more on the obstacle side. However, I think because of those things and my commitment, ambition, all those words that we said earlier, mm-hmm. it made the end result better. And I think that's changing as I see females engage in innovation and innovation ideas from a corporate perspective now, simply because of the huge commitment to diversity, the huge commitment by women helping to help other women. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I continue to see, and it's something that I talk to my team about, and I'll share with you all, especially for women who are entering the workplace who have an idea. And I, you know, this is big corporation, small corporation, it really doesn't matter. But what I talked about earlier about the very first time you pitch your idea, the very first time you share your idea, it can be a lonely place. And if you are a female and you're one of a few females in your tech department, few females in your law department, few females in your actuary department, in your data modeling department, it can be even lonelier for you to share that idea. And you're not, and so it takes a lot of courage. Yeah. So when these women do come and they share this idea with you, just keep that in mind and make the investment in them to make the idea 2.0 even better. Because I see men do it very naturally. They have decades of history of doing this, pumping each other up, doing that. And it's something that's learned. And in the innovation space, it's a lonely space. It takes a lot of courage. You're probably going to, I guarantee you're going to be told no at least once or twice. Mm-hmm. But as females, we have an opportunity to have deep conversations with women who have ideas to help make them better with words of encouragement. Or sometimes it's, don't say, this is a terrible idea. Don't say that. But things like, have you thought about this? This can make it better. Mm. So while I saw obstacles and kind of punched through them, I think now we have a huge opportunity to kind of use your female card a bit more and empower each other. And when you see those opportunities, recognize them for what they are to help the greater female workforce.
I love what Brené said when she said, if we don't know how we're gonna fall, we're never gonna fail. Mm. It's something like that, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think there's this idea of like almost getting excited for failure. Mm-hmm. I mean, I know that's in juxtaposition to what I said earlier, you have to believe, but like there have been plenty of fails along the way. So it's like, just know, like you're gonna fall.
You're making it better.
Yeah.
You'll do it better next time.
Right.
It'll be better next time.
You are gonna fall, like, but plan on how you're gonna get back up again. You know?
Right, and for females especially, I can't tell you enough, the younger women that I see enter the workforce, you can sometimes see their face like a light went out. And that's when you kind of hone in and say, no, it was no, but we still need to keep talking about something. There's nothing more depressing than seeing that in a woman's face. It's just, we can't stop, so.
And I also think you take those no's as a positive and like, okay, every time you get a no, that's great feedback. That's an obstacle that you've got to overcome. That's an objection you've got to overcome. That's something you've got to figure out that it's part of your journey. And no's are powerful and no's are good. It's the same thing as understanding what you're not going to do versus what you're going to do. And if it helps you stay more focused and it gets you in a better direction, thank you for that no. That's going to be helpful. And you may be very thrilled that down the road when you had that initial no because it sent you off in a better path.
I have a whole philosophy about no. There's, you know, the most probably popular and famous negotiation book in the world is called Getting to Yes. came out of Harvard. And in the book, there's a section where I talk about, you know, forget getting to yes, like get to know. Women have been saying yes for a really long time to a lot of things, right? In the case of Latinas, 55 cents on the dollar. Yeah, that's what we've been saying yes to, right? So, you know, no, I think that if anything, what we have to collectively do is we have to think about how to come to all of these tables, which are ultimately negotiation tables, and exercise that no muscle. All those things that we are either tacitly or, you know, not explicitly saying yes to, just to say, okay, you know, we're done. Yep. The answer is no now. So I want, you mentioned Brené Brown.
I did.
Who actually endorsed your book.
Yes.
Pretty amazing, and Perfect Courage. And in the book, you say that it's not about money or access, but it's about perfectionism and fear. And, you know, I talk a little bit about that as well. I talk about how we can't wait for people to get woke, right? And I tell one story in particular about a woman. How many people in the room know about a woman named Maggie Lena Walker? Is that name familiar? In the United States, she was the first, and I wonder worldwide whether she was the first, but she was the first woman to run a bank. And it happened before the Civil Rights Movement, and in fact, it happened before women got the right to vote in the United States. It happened in 1902. Maggie Lena Walker is a black woman in the United States who in 1902 ran a bank. And I tell stories like that because I think, you know, Maggie didn't wait for people to give her the right to vote, the right to drink out of the same water fountain, the right to, you know, she just took what was hers and she built something. And I think that that's the energy that I'm reminded of when I hear you say that it's about perfectionism and fear. And so what I would love to get from you is, especially drawn from the book or from your experience, what are the specific exercises or tactics that you recommend for overcoming the inevitable fear that we all face? It doesn't matter if you're beginning or if you've had, I'm on my sixth company.
Right.
That little voice that people call imposter syndrome that tells you, you know, even if the last thing was a success, maybe it was a fluke. Or if it was a failure, it's going to follow you, right? Those little voices, in my experience, are always there.
Yes.
How do you get over them?
Yeah, I really like to encourage people to look at their mindset. Because I think it's very easy to think, like, I don't have the right experience. Or you compare yourself and you're like, they have this and I don't have this. But really, you need to look at your internal story. What are the stories that you are telling yourself that are holding you back from moving forward? And I think for me, it was really embracing paradox. That we can be two things at once. That we can be scared and brave, that I could be curvy and I could run a fashion company, that I could be an entrepreneur and not take VC funds. Like, these things that I used to see as mutually exclusive really led me to this paralysis. And I think it's a perfectionistic way of thinking that I have to be one thing or I have to be another thing or I have to fit into this script and how I grew up or I have to fit into this script and how someone else is telling me to be. And instead, it really is breaking out of those boxes, erasing those lines, and holding these tensions. And for me, this whole idea of fear is just embracing the fear. Let it become your friend. You just can't let it be the boss of you. You can't let it be in the driver's seat. But fear is just part of the journey. So don't be afraid of fear. Don't let fear speak to you. Or don't let fear tell you what to do. Just say, fear, hey, what's up, girl? How are you doing? You can come with me. But you know what? I'm the boss. And that really is what courage is.
Another mic drop moment. Amy.
Yes, ma'am.
I talk about how many of us have ever seen, I think there are books on this, there are plenty of Instagram accounts that say this, the find your passion, follow your bliss. Who's ever heard that? Follow your bliss. Okay. When the average American family does not have $5,000 in their savings account, explain to me how you follow your bliss and everything just magically fixes itself. Like, who's paying the mortgage? Like, what if your bliss is ponies? How are you going to pay the mortgage with that, right? And so I have a hack that where I talk about forget passion, find things you want to punch. And I think about it that way because I think about so many businesses that are not solving a problem, right, that are not meeting a need that's really acute in the market, and then they die on the vine, right? And it's not shocking to me, as somebody who's been around the block a few times, that they do die on the vine because you didn't start off solving a really acute problem. And I think that if instead of this advice of, you know, follow your bliss and everything will magically resolve itself. If instead you made lists of find things you want to punch, whether it's internally at a corporation or externally as an entrepreneur, you're going to end up with a list of things that have a good fighting chance of having real business potential. Because if it's something you want to punch, I guarantee you that there's somebody else in the world who is really bothered by it as well. And then, you know, who knows, this thing might have legs. And that about your story is something that's really interesting to me, because at the end of the day, you found that market product fit, and you found it pretty early. And I guess my question for you, because it feels to me like that's the first criteria, right? Finding that thing that you want to punch, finding that thing that just drives you absolutely insane, that you think you could get also behind and excited about running a business and spending every waking hour on for the next foreseeable future, what are the sort of tests? What are the strategies? What are the things that they need to be asking themselves to test these ideas and see if it really has legs?
Gosh, great question. I have so many different answers. But, you know, for me, there's a risk factor with making that call to say, I'm going to fill this one gap and this one void. And kind of against all conventional wisdom where people tell you, don't put all your eggs in one basket. That's exactly what I did. I put all my eggs in one basket. And a little bit of it is luck, right? I have the right basket. But I put all my eggs in that basket, and I put my blinders on. I didn't focus on anything else. And people come to me with different ideas all the time, and not so much for the business, but, oh, you should go do payments for vacuum clean sales and dry cleaners and whatever. And it's not our niche. It's not our focus. And so being just hyper-focused, and everyone on our team and on our company, we know what we're doing. We know what our end goal is and our mission. And here we are, we're creating a payment company that professionals love. Nobody loves payments. Nobody loves their bank. So that's so unheard of in our industry. But it's all we do, and we do that one thing just amazing, and we're really good at it. There is a book called The One Thing. And so, I mean, I just encourage you, find your thing, and you can grow from that. But initially, if you're scattered and you're doing a little bit of everything, you just never really figure it out. You never get a rhythm. You never become the expert at that one thing. And it doesn't matter what it is. But then that becomes your passion, oddly enough, because that's your one thing, and you know that one thing better than anybody else in your entire industry, all the experts, all the analysts in the big banks and things like that, but nobody knows legal payments better than I do, or people in my company, that's for sure.
And I think one of the tough things about role models, I have an entrepreneur that I used to coach who would look at like the Martha Stewart empire and be like, that's what I want. It's like, yeah, but she started with one thing.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
And it wasn't until later that then it became this multi-tiered business that is now, you know, all over the place. But it didn't start off that way. It started as a singular focus. Because I want to be sure that we have plenty of time for Q&A, I would love if we got one sentence from you about what is the first step that you would take if you walked into this room and you had an idea and you wanted to do something to be able to take that first step. It's not going to get you all the way to the finish line, but just, you know, you've got to take that one first step forward. What would you tell folks in the audience to start with first? Leah, do you want to go first?
Sure. So I'll do it from a corporate environment perspective. If I had one idea that I really believed in, I would find a person in a department or an area that I'm not from, that I wasn't thinking about when I had my idea, and ask them what they think. So in my case, it would be somebody from the finance department. Here's my idea. It's great. Everybody's going to love it, and it solves this problem. It's going to be fantastic. You talk to the finance guy for the first time, and he's like, have you thought about this? No, I did not think about that. I'm gonna make my idea better. So that's what I would do. Talk to somebody that's kind of out of your genre, share your idea with them, and see what that conversation brings to you.
Amazing. Amy?
For me, when I see, especially on the entrepreneur side, people starting companies, is to not overthink it. You don't have to have a 3-year business plan, a 5-year business plan. You don't know what that's gonna look like. And so I see, people starting businesses, especially women, it's that perfectionism. They got to get it right. They've got to know all the details. They've got to have it perfectly planned out, and they've got these crazy to-do lists. You'll analyze that forever. You'll never actually start. So if you had to walk out of this room, I would say literally, go make a business card. Go buy a domain name. Those are you can buy a domain for
$12.
Oh, $20.
Right. Really, in that range.
Make it real, right? Like, take that first step. Make it real. Yeah. Get an email, get a phone number. Just make it real. And all of a sudden, thoughts are things. You start becoming this business owner. You're like, yeah, I have a business now.
Yeah.
It you can do that.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah, you can't finish what you don't start.
Yep.
And I remember my therapist telling me one time, and I'm like, man, Halloween's coming. I'm not going to eat that Halloween candy, because, you know. And then I ate the Halloween candy. I'm in her office the next night. I ate the Halloween candy. I just screwed it the rest of the week, and I just ate the Halloween candy. She's like, Jessica, just do the next right thing for your body. Do the next right thing for your body. So I've applied that to so many things in life. Like, do the next right thing for your idea. What is the next right thing you can do for your idea? Not the next 20 things, not the next 1,000. Then what is the one thing? Write it down. Everybody write down right now. What is the next right thing you can do for your idea? And go do it. And don't eat the Halloween candy. Still eating it. It's in the office.
That's the most challenging of all.
All right. Are we ready for some questions? Just for exercise sake, just see if your arm works, all of you. Just, you know, you're not asking yet. There you go. Now, my advice. Oh, wow.
Good question.
I know Tara has a question as well she's going to kick us off with. My advice is to look around at your sisters in the field and to use that as your inspiration about what it looks like to be an entrepreneur. I think that we have a dominant narrative, as I said in the beginning, that says and looks like Shark Tank at Silicon Valley, but the reality is the majority of entrepreneurs look like us, and struggle like us. And, you know, I think that that is probably the most important thing, because it's too daunting to look at people with trust funds and billion-dollar, you know, VC rounds and to say, I don't look like that. That doesn't look like my experience. But if you look around at everybody around you, you'll see tons and tons of inspiration. It's how I wrote my book. Thank you.
Thank you to our amazing speakers. Really, your stories are so inspiring, and thank you for sharing your expertise and insights. I was going to ask you to summarize your key takeaways, but I think you kind of did that.
Yeah.
But I do have another question before we open up to the audience.
And if you do have a question, go ahead and start walking up to the mic, please.
Walking up to the mic in the aisle, please. So you talked about really inspiring stories. You ran across obstacles. How did you stay motivated and persistent when things got really tough?
I'll go ahead and start. I think just believing you're the only person that has the most belief in whatever your idea is. So the moment that you stop, all the obstacles become unbearable. You can't do anything. So as long as you believe in what you're doing and you still have that fire in you, don't let it go out. Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, I've kind of figured out along the way, everything's figure outable. I don't know if that's a word, but it is.
I like it.
And when it just feels so heavy, and it's like, it's figure outable. And for the most part, no one's going to die if something goes wrong and if something happens horribly. And I've had to lay people off. I've had to fire people. I've had to do all those things. I tried to go too fast, tried to go too slow. You know, you never quite get it right. You're gonna mess up. Mm-hmm. It's okay.
Yeah. I think for me, taking the long view, because we did grow really quickly, really fast, and there was a point where things got really, really, really hard, and we were sitting on $1 million of excess inventory, and other people's lives around the world were counting on us to reorder, and it was a time of deep challenge. And I kind of can have this escapist mentality when things get hard. Like I said, the epidural, I was like, I gotta trap myself. So for me, taking quitting off the table so I'm not spending energy thinking, how do I get out of this difficulty, but more thinking about how am I gonna solve this difficulty, and then just reminding myself, like, I have what it takes. I have what it takes.
Mm-hmm. I have something similar to both you and Leah's. It just came in the form of some advice from a mentor of mine who is a world-renowned opera singer, knows nothing about tech, does not know an M&M from an M&A. But she's one of my best mentors, and she once told me, and it has become my mantra, you are the source of your own supply. And I say that when those voices come into my head and tell me, you know, I don't know if you can do this, Natalie. I repeat that phrase again and again, and it's definitely what keeps me going. May I ask that for the questions, if you specifically would like one of the panelists to answer, let us know. That'll be more efficient, and that way, if the four of us don't have to answer, then we won't.
Yeah, great. Yeah. With that, why don't we open it up to you all? If you could, please state your name before asking the question.
Hello, my name is Amanda, and I'm curious, I don't really care who answers the question, I guess whoever feels like they have a good answer.
we all do.
About bringing partners in with you. Mm-hmm. So you have the idea, you may not want to be the only one championing that idea. When do you know when to bring in those people, and any advice around that? Mm-hmm.
So I did bring on a partner about a year after starting, and that was when I realized I wanted to scale. Like, I literally wrote down, I want New Day Collection to be the world's largest fair trade accessories brand. And at that point, I began asking around for help. And I didn't know if it would have become in the form of a partnership or in the form of an angel investor that was going to write me a check that I would never have to pay back. But at that point, I just began talking to different people, and one of the people that I ended up talking with ended up wanting to become my business partner. And we became 50-50 business partners. So we were actually, I have two husbands, a husband in real life and a business husband fully. And it was the right partnership. That's a very, that's innovative in itself, to be able to have a successful 50-50 partnership in a business. But for me, it was about, he has an operation and finance background, I did not. So it was owning what I'm good at and owning what I'm not good at. And we really came together, and we've been able to make some great magic.
And the investor in me says, please have them vest over time so that they start at a certain percentage and then earn up to whatever percentage you've agreed. If, in your case, if it was 50, you might have worked out beautifully from the beginning. But I've worked with too many lawyers not to say, have them vest over time. So whatever it is that they're going to have as partners, that they vest over time, and that you have clear success metrics that say, if we achieve this goal, if you deliver the following, then you can basically graduate up to whatever that is, 30, 40, 50%, whatever those things are. That would be my advice.
Hi, my name is Christina, and my question is, what is the right balance between listening to your gut feeling versus hard data or market trends?
So it's funny, actually, I wish I had a whiteboard, actually. we just had this discussion in one of our exec meetings, and we had, on one axis, we had data, and on the bottom axis, we had gut. Mm. And if the data said yes and the gut said yes, that was a go, start tomorrow, or start, leave this office, let's go. If it was high data, low gut, we were gonna test. If it was high gut, low data, I'm sorry, the other way around, we were gonna test. And then obviously, if it was low gut, low data, that was just take it off the table. Let's just not waste our time talking about it another second. Mm. But figure out that what quadrant and make your decisions and go fast. Mm. It allows you to go faster.
And I think in a corporate environment, if you, small or large business, both of them, there are people whose jobs is to have all the data.
Right.
So keep your gut and have some data, but there are departments that can double down on that data when you really need it. So be mindful of it, but you're not gonna probably have as much as those departments will.
I had an entrepreneur wait until about the 11th hour. We were a few days from wiring funds, changed the terms on me. And I came back and I said, the deal's off. And he said, no, I thought we would negotiate. But I knew that even if we had gotten to an agreement, what he had shown me was that he was the kind of person who will change the terms on me at the 11th hour, and that's not the sort of person that my gut tells me that I ever want to be working with. And so he thought he was trying to negotiate something from me, and he killed the deal mm-hmm. because my gut mm-hmm. was screaming. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure.
Hi, I'm Beth. I have a question in particular for Amy. As you think about the payment space, it's really, really broad, and there's lots of different niches in merchant acquiring in particular. When you were picking what niche industry to support and then thinking also about wanting to have a long-term career growth, how did you balance the niche that you were going to serve and the need for scale?
It's a great question. We kind of looked at a profile of somewhat of a niche that wasn't just selling product. So at the time when I started the company, there was a lot of online shopping carts and things like that. And when you looked at those solutions, they all included shipping and tax and things like that. So they weren't the right solution for professional services. So when we looked at filling that need, we identified really licensed professionals that were part of a professional trade organization, trading hours for dollars and required continuing education. So we had a matrix that identified, and they had the numbers. So there are a lot of lawyers, so that was a good market for us. And I'll tell you a failure story. Before I landed on lawyers, I tried to do psychology, and I still have thousands of psychologists that use our platform, and I partnered with the Texas Psychological Association, so they fit all these check boxes: licensed professional, trading hours for dollars, part of a professional trade association. But it turns out there's not as many of them, and they bill $35, so that wasn't as interesting. So I took those same parameters and applied it to legal.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's
great.
Hi, I'm Rhonda, and in the spirit of sisterhood, I'm up here asking this question for a friend who was too tired to get up tonight.
Beautiful.
So she wants to know, and it can be from anyone, in hindsight, and with the value of hindsight, what thing screams at you that you would have done differently along the way if you had it to do over again?
Mine's very easy. I don't think that I would have changed anything, but I would have cut myself some slack. My path has been very circuitous. And while I don't think I would have changed the decisions, I was very hard on myself every time I made those pivots. And I just think I would have made the same decisions and cut myself a little slack.
Mm. Yeah, I wasted a lot of energy feeling a lot of shame around being a good mom and a good CEO of a startup. So I had 3 kids, 5 and under, and then this new baby that was a startup. And I burned a couple of good years just spinning my wheels there. And the thing is, when we're spinning our wheels on these internal things, and it's not forward moving, we're taking away from our business. And so I really regret not just embracing freedom and my purpose, and that I could be a good mom and a damn good CEO all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. I will share. I got the best text on the way here. So the mom guilt is completely real. It is a big thing. But now my daughter, who I used to stress about not spending enough time with and going on field trips and things like that, which, by the way, I don't think I missed out on a whole lot there. Just kidding. but just kidding. But she texted me down today and just said, "I'm proud of you, Mama." And so for me, that was huge. And so, you know, we've come a long way, and it's been pretty cool.
Yeah, if I think back, that whole notion, the whole thing that I talked about, you know, your first idea probably is not going to be the what goes forward exactly as you thought it the first. Yeah, I didn't know that. Yeah. So, you know, in hindsight, your perfection probably isn't going to be with the very first idea that you come out with. The first time it comes out of your mouth. Yes, we're all brilliant. It's brilliant, but you might want to change it a little bit. In hindsight, I wish I would have known that, because exactly what everybody says, you're not as hard as yourself on yourself. You're able to let in other information, all of those things. Mm-hmm. So it's a work in progress.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Rosie. My question is for you, Natalie. Would you have any tips or tricks for the pitch?
Tips for what?
The pitch, whenever you're hearing a pitch.
Yes, I do. Two of my biggest pet peeves, I'll make it quick, are people hide their numbers. And they bury them in... And by the way, who said the business plan thing? About don't worry about... Well, yeah. It's been well over a decade since I read a business plan. I go to the... If somebody was to give me a business plan, I would go to the table of contents and skip to the finance section, just so we're clear. But more importantly, when someone buries the numbers and the ask in slide number whatever, right, it tells me that you're not confident about your numbers, and you want to say the opposite. You want to put it in the beginning, you want to put it in the end, and maybe even in the middle again, right? Because you just kind of want to put it front and center and be unapologetic about the fact that you're asking for this, whatever this is. The other thing, too, is that people spend too much time focusing on the problem. And maybe it's just me being impatient, but I often sit through pitches going, what is it? Like, I get it.
You and I are very similar.
Oh, my God. Like,
all
the
bottom
stats.
Line. You're a bottom line girl.
The stats and the issue. And, okay, yes. But, like, what is it? You know, and you don't want people sitting there going, oh, I'm bored already. Right? So I think that in both cases, both the financials and then the what it is, needs to come really, really early and, if possible, multiple times. And then the other thing is just in terms of networking and getting those appointments, I always say make like a goldfish who has no short-term memory. There's a lyric of a song that I love where the little plastic castle is a surprise every time to the little fish. So if I get an email 2, 3, 4 times and the person says, I've emailed you 4 times and you haven't responded, that means that the feeling that I'm getting from that email is this person is being a little hostile, this person's a little frustrated with me. It's not going to be the top priority for me to respond to. But that person who every time they email me, it's like the first time. Hey, Natalie, I saw you speak at this thing. Hey, Natalie, I did it. You know, I read this article. I thought you might like to read it.
That's such a good idea.
Every time, it's like it's the first time. And the person isn't guilt-tripping me into it being the fourth or the fifth. And sometimes it is the fourth or the fifth before I respond. That is going to get you a response.
Mm, that's good.
Excellent. Thanks so much.
Of course. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Abby Abimbola. Everyone calls me Abby. I'm an analyst at Visa. I just wanted to know, because I can say in my experience, mentorship and networking, it tends to come up a bit. And I wanted to know what role, if any, did a mentor or networking play as it relates to your innovative idea and supporting your careers?
One of the things that I really like about mentors, official mentors or unofficial mentors, is generally, you're in a spot where you're vulnerable. So when you are sharing things and your idea is not so good, not baked out, there's a very basic question that you didn't answer, your mentors have a way of being able to carry that into a conversation. And so having mentors has really helped me from a place of, okay, I know I can be vulnerable. I know we can have a conversation. And when I'm done, wow, I'm more confident in that idea that we were talking about. Even if the mentor didn't necessarily say, talk to X, Y, and Z, and Sally over here, and do this step, that step, the other, just the conversation, I think, for mentors provides us with great confidence of just saying things out loud that may have been in our head.
Don't forget about peer mentorship. That's something that I've mainly have done over the last few years, and that has been essential. I'm on the phone at least once every other week with someone where we're mentoring one another. We're peers, we're leaders of organizations, but we are mentoring each other.
I think the peer mentorship point
is really important, too. I worry about that, especially in large corporations, because when you're the only woman at the executive level, you're the only woman of color in the board or anything like that, guess who gets asked to give all the speeches? Guess who gets asked to mentor all the people, right? And then you have that added part of your day, which is to serve everyone. And so that's an important and tough ask, right? And so it becomes even more important that those peer mentorships be how people thrive.
And it takes work. It takes time. And I know Jessica, for example, is part of a group called EO. I'm a member of a group called YPO. But those are things, they take time. And sometimes I have to go to the meetings. I'm like, oh, my gosh, and one more thing I've got to do. But I get there, and I was like, it fills your tank, and it inspires you. And it's putting yourself in situations where you are around other professionals and other people looking to do what you want to do. When I joined YPO, a quick example is another woman in YPO came up to me and said, what do you talk to your girlfriends about? And I was like, oh, we talk about the kids, we talk about this. And he goes, do you talk to your girlfriends about your business? I'm like, they wouldn't really get it. Or they wouldn't care. They don't really know about it. Just that's why you need YPO. That's why you need your peer groups and your mentor groups. And so she kind of, that light bulb went off for me, and she was right.
There's the whole list of them in LeapFrog. Black Female Founders is an amazing group. Dreamers and Doers is an amazing group. Lots and lots of these groups that are popping up left and right, because some of these great ones that you mentioned require that your business be of a certain size or at a certain level, which is fine. You can graduate to those levels, but some of these other ones that I mentioned are more sort of entry level, if that makes sense.
Awesome. Thank you so much, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're out of time, so please come up and speak to the speakers after the session's over. Thank you for taking the time to come and hear these amazing women. Please give them another round of applause.
Stay there. I want to stop. Thank you.